Welcome back to Warning Shot, night after the State of the Union, and a lot of interesting things to talk about the speech. But do the outburst by the crazies, Congresswoman Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, tell us more about the State of the Union than the speech does, Joel?
My God, it tells us one thing. I think Joe Wilson probably was blushing last night at how out of control Lauren Boebert was interrupting the president just as he's about to talk about people dying from cancer. And everybody in the room knew he was going to talk about or imply his son dying. So Lauren Boebert demonstrating the kind of deep lack of human respect that we now see surging into our politics from the far right. And it's very disturbing and very anti-American.
And with that, I want to bring our guest, a fun guy to have on, Brian Karem from Salon.com, who has had crazies yell at him in the Rose Garden.
You mean the president?
I still got odds that Brian could take Sebastian Gorka. Brian, your reaction to both the outbursts in the State of the Union, but the State of the Union in general.
Well, let's start with the outburst first. When I was a kid, I remember going to the grocery store, and on occasion, my pops and I, you know, going to the grocery store, would see a bunch of nuns. And we were always deferential to the nuns, very nice to them. And then on occasion, I remember there would be people heckling the nuns, you know, going, hey, why don't you all get a mini skirt? Hey, why don't you go out and date? You all people are horrible. And I remember my dad going, what kind of rednecks heckle nuns? And, of course, we found out last night. I mean, the president is talking about his dead son and cancer, and you've got Boebert and Greene standing up like literally school children, I mean, preschool children.
His dead son, who served this country, by the way, he's talking about, he was trying to say maybe this happened to him while he was in uniform.
There you go.
Yeah. In the country. Let's remember that. This is not just, hey, let me bring up my son for sympathy.
Of course, it wasn't.
He was using that to show his empathy for soldiers.
Yeah. And, you know, if I can add to that, the veterans component, right? Like, he cares about veterans. This is like a big part of him and American culture. And they disrespected veterans there as well.
Well, they disrespect themselves when they speak every time. So they're not going to be able to respect anyone else because they disrespect themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, to the bigger point about the speech itself, I think there were some very salient points that were made last night that may have gone past some of the viewers because they were too busy worried about Boebert and some of the other things. But the big point last night that we all should be paying attention to is the precipice upon which we sit internationally because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The president of the United States said for the, you know, umpteenth time that the red line in the sand is if NATO assets are attacked. Look, I've covered wars. I've been in shooting situations. They call it the fog of war for a reason. There's no way that you can guarantee that even if the Russians say, I'm not going to attack NATO assets, that, you know, a stray missile, a stray bullet doesn't hit a NATO asset. And at that point in time, we're in a full shooting war with Russia. Not since the Cuban Missile Crisis has this world been in such a dangerous place. Even more so today, because even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that was a Russian proxy, Cuba. These are actual Russian troops involved in the largest land war in Europe since the end of World War II. If we don't take this seriously, it's going to bite us in places that we don't want to be bitten. And the next 6 weeks are tantamount to it's a crucible through which this world will be born.
But let me ask you, you said that it was sort of a little subtle there and whatnot. Can you peel that back a little? Why do you think Americans get it? Do you think?
No, I don't. I think it's obvious that we don't get it because you got Boebert or at least a portion of the country doesn't get it because you got people like Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene standing up acting like asses, not realizing what the central message is about unity and about standing together, and the fact that NATO has remained strong despite Trump trying to tear it apart, despite Putin trying to tear it apart. You have Biden saying, listen, we will stand firm. And here's the other thing that was really telling. In the last 6 to 8 weeks, the American intelligence on what Russia was going to do has been excellent. And in fact, he foretold everything that Biden foretold everything that Putin was going to do, and they did it, which tells you we have pretty good intelligence inside the Kremlin, A, and B, it is a dangerous situation. And unfortunately, I don't think there are people who really get it. They're still playing, you know, baseball.
On their part, Brian, when you're talking about don't get it, and you were, you know, for our audience, you were the first reporter in liberated Kuwait City, right?
Yep.
So I see that war, the first Persian Gulf War, as kind of a tipping point in this, we don't get it, because that war played out on CNN, right? That, and did that war desensitize us? Are we watching this the way we would watch the NBA playoffs or WWE wrestling? Do people see this as over there and they don't understand? Because your point about the fog of war and NATO assets, we're talking about NATO assets are on the border of Ukraine.
Yeah.
We're talking about airspaces where we're scrambling. There may be dogfights, there may be unarmed dogfights. A few years back, Turkey shot down a Russian jet. So do people, should we, does the media owe us a kind of a look behind the curtains, how close we could be to a war?
Yeah, but we're too inexperienced to understand it. You have reporters in the briefing room of the White House asking Jen Psaki if stationing troops near Ukraine means a permanent presence of American troops in Europe. We've had a permanent presence.
Boy, that'd be a novel idea. Interesting.
And you had someone the other day going, will this lead to an actual war? And she said to say, well, this is an actual war. We don't get it because we are too inexperienced to cover it. But more to your point, look, Russia knows that the world has vowed to arm Ukraine. The major supply route for anything, for humanitarian or for military resources, yeah, is through Poland.
That's
Poland.
Right.
So if there is one Russian troop that sets foot in Poland, it's over with. That's a large World War III shooting war. And how close, how soon before somebody presses the button?
On that, just Joel, I'd like you to comment on this, yeah, too. It is Poland, too, because Hungary said we're not letting anything through.
Yeah.
Right? And that's Orban, who's the part of the problem, too. So
here's the thing that's really troubling with what you're both talking about that really makes me nervous about this situation is Putin is all invested now in this war. 3/4 of Russia's military is invested in this war. He can't lose, right? And if you get inside that head, you think, my God, this is it. This is it. And so to the point of risk tolerance, he may continue to have a higher and higher and higher tolerance the longer this goes, and the realization that China's not exactly thrilled.
No. Nations
are blocking. others don't want to pour in. His economy's tanking. And, he's in a quagmire. And so now you're an American viewer and you're watching this and you're saying, we got to stay out. But there's a Putin continuing to menace, continuing to go. What kind of questions, if you're in the White House briefing room, are you thinking about before you go in and talk to Jen? And Jen, for people who aren't familiar with Jen Psaki, she was the State Department spokesperson, yes, when I was at State. She knows this stuff cold. This is not like a new field for her. She knows, yes, national security. Like, what do you do to help the American people actually understand this situation right now if you're a reporter going in there and actually care about what the American people?
Well, your question is the one that I have. Jen, what can you say to the American people at this point in time to let them know the seriousness of what we face? Instead of saying, if we have 6 or 8 people in our embassy in Russia, are we going to be okay? You know, some of the stupid don't get me started. We ask the dumbest damn questions in that briefing room, and none of them have anything to do with what's actually going on. And it's frightening to me that we don't get it. Psaki does get it. She has been there. But some of the questions I have to ask, I can't ask in a briefing room, because the simple fact of the matter is I'm not going to get the answer, because in a briefing room environment, what you're looking at is a reiteration of existing policy and making sure that you don't step out of bounds. What I really want to know is, look, there are three or four ways this plays out, but there's one way that is most intriguing. With the amount of intelligence that we've had prior to the run up to the invasion, and in fact the actual invasion, with the amount of intelligence that we've had, it's obvious to me and to anyone who's covered these issues that we got somebody on the inside talking to us, right? So it's not just the ability to trap phones and to get on a computer and hack a computer. There has to be actual human assets involved. Are they close enough to the subject, Putin, to understand his mindset, A? B, will these sanctions, they're designed to hurt Putin and the oligarchs. Are we trying to influence a regime change in Russia? And do we think that it will occur because of these sanctions? Those are the questions that need to be answered so we can understand the depth of our despair and the very trying times in which we live. Because, as I said, look, it could end with Putin backing down and going, okay, fine. It could be, you know, and I don't see that happening offhand. There are people who think that this will last 10 or 20 years. Mazel tov, if it lasts 10 or 20 years, that means we won't have blown ourselves up. That, you know, I'm more worried about the next 6 to 8 weeks. And then so that's how it could end as well.
I'm at 6 to 8 weeks, Brian. You know, the president yesterday in the State of the Union addressed inflation in general, right? Yeah. He said, I get it. But he was talking about inflation as existed. Pricing is about to go out of control because of energy prices. The energy crisis in Europe was fully underway even before this invasion. Right. The Russians are already, we've seen this yesterday, the Russian ambassador is saying, the Russian ambassador to Cyprus is saying, you're not going to get tourists. He's telling Greece, you're not going to get tourists. We're all going to Turkey, which is fine, go to Turkey. I don't know that their tourists are going to have any money to spend anyway. But clearly, Russia is going to take, it's going to use every last piece of its economic leverage. It's looking for fissures. How long can this unanimity in the West hold? Yes.
Well, that's the question.
And you know, we could talk about this later. I am not entirely confident that we're taking moves right now to reassure the population of our allies over the long haul. Is anybody asking this question?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And what the president has said, and this is another one of those questions, how come the sanctions haven't worked yet? How come they're not punitive enough? Well, he said himself it's going to take a month.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go back and visit it in a month and see. And he has introduced additional sanctions since he made that statement. But the ultimate question, and that's where Putin is trying to play the long game. And so, by the way, is Biden. Biden's not stupid. He's been on the international stage for many years. He knows Biden. Biden knows Putin pretty well. What Putin is betting on is that they'll lose the midterm elections. Right, that the Democrats will lose, and then the Republicans will take over and strangle the American government. And further down the road is also playing the game that we won't stay, the solidarity among our allies will fall apart as we lose the midterm, as the Democrats lose the midterms, and the Democrats lose in 2024.
Let me ask you, let me try to get under that little rock there that you put out there, which is the politics of this and the politics of the right wing, the politics of the Republican Party, which clearly is divided right now with traditional hawks versus like a Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz, you know, very counterproductive thinking in my mind in terms of coalition building. Nonetheless, they're on the right. And then you've got this sort of Boebert, Green, Trump, Putin fanboy wing of the Republican Party. And so you have this dynamic. Let's say you're right. Let's say the midterms go south for the Democrats. The Republicans get a little more juice. It's 6 to 8 months later. The economy is feeling the pinch. The stalemate is there underway. What kind of demagoguing, to use the phrase, what kind of politicization of national security are we likely to see from the Republicans to do the kind of you can see where I think about this, but to do the kind of disrespectful thing that Bober did last night, which is to mock a man just before he's about to talk about the death of his son, who's a veteran, right? Like, there are no lows low enough, and it keeps on getting lower. So what happens in the politics of this if that scenario plays out in our elections?
Well, if past is prologue, we disintegrate, and that's exactly what Putin is gambling on in the long run, and Biden is gambling on the long game of us staying together and fighting the good fight. And look, the two parties in this country, I'll say it and I've said it before, you have one party that is a party of no heart, and then the other part is a party of no head. And while the Democrats have a superior message for the American public, they're horrible at communicating with the American public why the American public should side with them. And the Republicans, or as James Carville once told me, he said, look, I don't agree with the Republicans, but you got to admire their work ethic. The Republicans will take up all the airwaves, social and media and traditional media, and just spew their venom. And people go, oh, they must be right. Oh, they must be right. Well, they must be right. And so that's the problem that we have, that we face going forward. And that's a problem that Biden faces. But look, you cannot what we cannot lose sight of is the fact that this is a very dangerous situation. And I always, when people are saying how dangerous, I go, well, look, did you ever see The Hunt for Red October? And you know, people go yes or no. I go, there's a great scene in that movie where the Secretary of State, Van Pelt, played by Richard Jordan, I think, is talking to his Andrei Gromyko or whoever it is, his counterpart in Russia. And he says, look, having your troops and our troops in such close proximity is inherently dangerous. Wars have started that way. You can't say it any more bluntly than that. If we don't dial it back, it will dial itself up. And that's the word that's the message that Biden has to spread. And by the way, that's why he got a standing ovation, a bipartisan standing ovation last night, is because there are enough people who recognize this, even in the Republican Party. And you're right, the hawks will side with him. And that's the unity he's talking about. You're never going to get the Boberts or the Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, they're not on the Foreign Affairs Committee anyway.
Thank God.
I'm not really worried about that.
No, I mean, worry about their constituents. And worry about their media presence.
Yeah,
and worry about the media.
But while Joel, I mean, and here's something we also, going forward, this has to be clear, because they've been really good about forecasting, the Biden administration, about forecasting the intelligence. Yeah. But because Joel criticize Cruz and Rubio, and we can debate about whether they're good at coalition building, but it wasn't the mixed messaging that really came from the Biden administration about Nord Stream at the end of last year part of the problem today? Isn't that one of the
reasons?
Isn't that one of the reasons?
Speaking to the point I made, they're horrible when it comes to communicating.
Yeah, but so isn't that something we got? Because if we're playing the long game,
yeah,
here's a difference in our long game and their long game.
Yeah,
his long game, he has to just dig in. Our long game, we have to hold a coalition together.
Yes.
And we have to hold a coalition together when there's an extreme political incentive because of our thing called democracy, where they're looking for votes. Complimenting Joe Biden right now, if you're a Republican, is not a vote getter in your party. And in an autocracy like Vladimir Putin, he doesn't really pay attention at all. I don't think
he cares. Just kills the opposition.
He just kills the opposition, right?
So any reporter reports on the opposition.
And this is a major significant challenge. And there will be, you're right, though, to the point about Nord Stream 2, this question about how fast, how far. But the thing that's fascinating to me about the way Biden has flipped the Germans, because frankly, the Germans flipped themselves, but Biden really orchestrated that, and there's a great little nugget of irony in this, is that the Assistant Secretary for Europe is the single most expert on German relations. And she is in this job now. She's been orchestrating this behind the scenes to manage the German relationship to move them. Ted Cruz held up nearly 60 senior officials to the State Department, ambassadors and assistant secretaries, until the Nord Stream 2 project was killed, kneecapping our ability to actually engage in diplomacy effectively. And so there's a lot of domestic politics wrapped into this. So I would say I concur. We can have a debate about Cruz on the policy. But what he did was he undermined our national security.
Well, he always does.
Holds on all these people for that policy.
Look, he's a moron and doesn't understand. You know, there are those who say, oh, Cruz is conniving. No, he's a moron. But to your
point, take Cruz out of the equation.
Hold on. Your point about the Germans. This is another a place where I feel like the administration has failed to communicate effectively with the American public, because it was after a meeting with Biden that the Germans flipped. And that's huge. And look, I know it. I know the influence that the Biden administration had on the Germans, and that should be one of their talking points. And they don't do it. He has held a coalition together so far that people thought they would never even have. That's the frightening point.
Take those tactics out. Take Cruz aside. Yeah. The point is that when did we have this intelligence? If we knew Russia was doing this, why the difference on our rhetoric on Nord Stream in November and then January? Now, I understand, and you're right, Joel, and I grant that. Showing the Germans that you can bring them along slowly is fine, but did we just wake up January and say, oh, they finally got the troops there?
No.
And frankly, and this is a big worry. Nord Stream, the certification has been suspended. Nord Stream could be back online in 6 months. And this is a danger right now. How long?
Well, that's what
we willing to do. I don't think it will be, because the German public is so turned off right now about being dependent upon Russia for energy. And that's why the bit of the long game with the orchestration by the Biden team is so effective, because ultimately we can't tell the Germans what to do and have it be sustainable. But if the German public and politics shifts, that's sustainable. And they have shifted now. They made their own decision on it. Clearly we, as Brian said, pushed them through that door. But by doing
it, as we introduced him to the door, hey, it's bright and sunny on the other side. Come on and join us.
But I will give Cruz credit for highlighting it. Absolutely. But what he did was he burned the ground in order to do that. Yeah. And the ground, we needed to stand on firm ground in this period.
Well, and to your point about Nord Stream, you can also, it's still an incentive. It's suspended now. It could be back on track. But that's an incentive to Russia to say, hey, look, you want it? Back off. Well, you know, there's money to be made for everybody. I mean, the bottom line is that we're gambling, that their desire for money, their greed, will overcome their desire to overrun Ukraine and force World War III. That's, hey, look, back off, guys. There's plenty of money to be made for everybody. Now, that's a cynical way to look at it for some, but it's also part of the equation.
But you're speaking to the truth, which is ultimately this probably does not end with one side winning a military victory. This ends with some type of an agreement after God knows how much pain to get there. So what's in that agreement? What are the tradable assets?
The hope is that this is a negotiating tactic for money and not the opening moves of a madman who wants to overrun the world. And he has gone back to saying, look, there are those who are joking he got stuck because of COVID in a basement looking at old maps of the Soviet Union. And he has said he wants to take it back to the 1922 boundaries. Well, there are some NATO nations that were part of the Soviet Union back then. If he's serious about that, folks, we're talking real serious World War III stuff. And so you have to wonder what's the problem with Putin, like Trump, and we have less of an ability with Putin to decide, because as much as Trump ranted and raved, you could also see behind the curtain with him, because he just liked to put it out there, baby. I mean, he'd be out there he'd be calling us the enemy of the people while at the same time talking to us all the time. Putin just kills the opposition and the and the press that opposes him. So you're not really sure, or can't be really sure, the general public can't really be sure of what his motives are. And we have, going back to intelligence, have to hope that our intelligence is such that we have a better idea.
Speaking of the public, because you used hope in a couple a few times in this last section, and I hope is not a strategy, unfortunately. But one of my favorite articles of last year was yours on Salon, where you said, "Dumbass nation, our biggest national security problem is America's vast and militant ignorance." One thing that I'm really worried about that is not in the discussion yet, coming out of the administration, but you're seeing it pop up in left, on the left and on the right, is a win for Putin here. It would be the Finland, like the Finland's type status for Ukraine, a neutral.
Right.
Well, no EU, no NATO. Right. And since Joel referred to a possible agreement, if the Russians said, if that's part of the agreement, so what?
Give up everything you want, and I'll take it.
This is what I'm worried about. What if they start targeting our dumbass nation with this Finland scenario? We see people on Twitter already talking about it. Why are we not getting ahead of it and saying, I talked about it in the last, there was a leftist parliamentarian, former minister in Europe, who said, well, we should support a truly independent and neutral Ukraine. Well, Ukraine just has to be part of the EU. Ukraine itself doesn't want to be that neutral. But that talking point is coming at us. Why are we not addressing it now?
Well, the title of the headline should say it all. Dumbass nation.
We know dumbass nation. Our talking against our government, dumbass government.
I think the Biden team was arguing for a long while that the sovereignty of Ukraine, ultimately, it's their decision. It's their decision. But, I think that the problem that we have, certainly as Democrats, is we don't stay on message forever. Right. So we did it for a while and now it's gone. I totally agree with you. It's the right message, but it's kind of like faded away.
Democrats are horrible at messaging. That you're just horrible. You pass an infrastructure bill that if that were Trump and he ever managed to pass anything that significant, he'd have that's all he would talk about until the midterms. And, the Democrats got like a week. Look, I attended a bipartisan gathering of about 1,000 people on the South Lawn of the White House and watched while Democrats and Republicans came up to Biden afterwards and thanked him. I mean, I stayed out there till the very bitter end when Biden walked away, and almost every single Republican went up and shook his hand and thanked him. Why have the Democrats given up the messaging on that issue, which would rally the American public to their cause a little bit better? Instead, I'm having to hear about B cubed, bring back better. It's,
But beyond messaging, this is not only messaging. This is intelligence. This is part of a hybrid war. They're going to see, the Russians see the division in our Twitter sphere, right?
Well, they're going to amplify.
They're going to amplify the person who says, all right, let's make Ukraine neutral and then we avoid war. And there are people on the left already saying Finland's been at peace since the end of World War II, right? So we have to, as Joel said, we should not give up this message. And frankly, beyond sovereignty, one of the things that we did not talk about during that messaging phase, Joel, is that how bad it is to let the world be divided into spheres of influence. That a neutral status for Ukraine is conceding a sphere of influence to the bad guys. And if you concede a sphere of influence to Russia in Ukraine, what do you have to concede to China? What do you have to concede to Turkey? What do you have to concede to Iran? And that conversation has not been had at all.
We don't know what's been had inside.
Go ahead, Brian.
We don't know what's been had inside or through diplomatic channels, but we do know this, and to the point made earlier, the simple fact of the matter is that's part of the Russian long game, too. Disinformation, misinformation to try and drive a wedge in the American public.
I wanted to ask you about that because I think Andy's point, it points to some of the rot that's been at our politics the past 5-6 years and the sort of disinformation subculture that is part of the way people now think, as exemplified by Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are the sort of test tube babies of what happens if you create a disinformation pregnancy and now, boom, pop them. All right. So,
cool,
so
that's lovely think, test tubes.
You know, I mean, let's just call a spade a spade. They are their entire existence is to spread disinformation at this point. So my question to you then is you have watched this up close and personal, Brian, for the last half dozen years. If Donald Trump were in the White House right now, instead of Joe Biden, what would the reaction be to the Putin massing of troops? And remember, John Bolton said this on Newsmax the other day. The only reasons the Russians didn't invade before was because their military wasn't ready. It wasn't because Trump was in the White House. Of course, taking Bolton at his word, if Trump were in the White House today, based upon what you saw, what would the United States be doing?
Well, I joked before, but it's not far from the truth. If Donald Trump were in the White House right now, we'd have troops on the ground in Ukraine fighting with Russia. He is such a apologist for Russia. If he were in office right now, the truth of the matter is he would say what he's saying now, genius and savvy. And this is making the world more stable. It would be a host of rhetoric. Let me tell you something. Donald Trump is not the guy who's going to put boots on the ground anywhere to defend the United States. That's not his, he's a coward. He's a blowhard, con man, coward. So we would be in a worse situation now further down the road because we wouldn't have anybody with backbone. Can you imagine Donald Trump? You know, Zelensky is standing in a bunker in Ukraine. We're offering to get him out. And he says, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition. Now, there's a line worthy of a comedian. He knows how to deliver a punchline, but it's honest to God, night and day between Zelensky and Trump. Trump, who had bone spurs, Zelensky, who's going to stay and fight to the end. In fact, it was his his Zoom call, I think it was, to the leaders of the European Union. And he said, look, you may not see me anymore after this. Right. I could be dead. Help. That prompted some of the help that he's gotten. That's Donald Trump in no way could handle this on the international stage. He couldn't handle the COVID virus. He couldn't handle losing. He couldn't handle anything that ever came his way.
Couldn't handle BLM protests. Yeah.
He couldn't. Well, yeah. How he handled that, and I was there for that, was to send the military out, gas the crowd so he could have a stand up in front of a church with a Bible that he held upside down. Donald Trump is not the guy that you want in the office right now. Biden, with his experience, is. And whether you agree or disagree with him, the world's a safer place for him being there.
Well, it's specifically because he's held together a coalition. And Senator Romney gave him that credit. I mean, I can't imagine none of this works if the European Union was not on board. Right. The European Union was the enemy. Could you argue that the Biden administration could have been stronger?
Sure.
You think, yeah, they could have been stronger, but you won't know if Europe would have went along. The unanimity is what's important. This is something that's very important for us, especially when it comes to the EU. An EU and a United States and Canada acting together, and Japan, by the way, on economic pressure, that makes a huge difference. And this is why we as a country have to get over this. Like, the EU became a punching bag in some sense for good reasons, not spending enough on defense, but the EU is our most important partner. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing this, and we have to turn and figure this out.
You know, indirectly, what we're all talking about here is American ignorance of international policy and the ugly American and our nationalistic tendencies to say, hey, if it happens outside of the United States, well, we don't care. I mean, the scary part of it is we need to be more cognizant of international politics and international issues. But it's hard to get that done in a country that doesn't value education or information, and the media has been compromised for the last 40 years by big business and big government.
You know, there's one thing I also feel like I really want to highlight that we didn't touch on, but I think it cuts across what we're talking about, which regarding Biden's leadership. sometimes it's what you don't do that's as important as what you do do.
Yeah.
And after Vladimir Putin threatened nuclear war, what did Biden do?
Not a day. He did not take the bait.
Didn't take the bait. He pulled back. He's Psaki, experienced spokesperson, said, this is the kind of rhetoric that we're used to seeing. Biden, there isn't going to be a nuclear war. Every nuclear expert
we don't know.
Said that was the perfect response to de-escalate. If he could have easily gone fire and fury, Trump style, and we would have been on the brink of a nuclear war. And that is a unique American role. NATO can't deal with that. The EU can't deal with that. We are the nuclear superpower.
Well, it was the perfect response. You're right, Joel. That is the perfect response. And that was the one we were all hoping for. Anybody who's ever even watched Star Trek, you know, when the Romulans and Picard face off, he goes, somebody's got to trust somebody. Who's going to drop their shield first? Me. So, you know, you exhibit some trust and de-escalate. Yeah, but we don't know what we're dealing with in Russia. I took great comfort in what Biden said last night in the speech when he said, we're going to be okay. That was nice to hear. And I hope, and you hope that that opinion is based on knowledge that we don't have, and you have to trust him that it is.
Well, but that was a perfect response on the nukes.
Oh, absolutely.
That was a perfect response. But there's a lot of other, you know, yesterday I was heartened by him announcing that we're closing skies. But why were we last? Why was Belgium ahead of us? There's this impression, and there are, you know, leaks, and I mean, it could be speculation, that there is endless debate within the National Security Council about even, for example, sharing intelligence with Ukraine. There's a team in the National Security Council saying, well, that would make us co-belligerents. Well, since we have economic sanctions anyway and kind of an embargo, and Russians have declared that an act of war, we're co-belligerents anyway. Are we being almost too methodical in some sense? And why are smaller European nations kind of ahead of us? But like, again, in closing the airways.
In the end, does it matter
whether they're
too different, or does it matter that we got there? I think those will be matters of debate if things stand down. And
well, right now it matters. I agree with you. It matters that we got there. But yeah, in holding a coalition together, if this holds on, like you said, 6-8 weeks from now, if the status quo maintains, doesn't it matter that the U.S. is leading rather than being leading from the front, rather leading from behind?
At risk of using a phrase that I will bite my tongue. I will not say that phrase, leading from, and I won't say it. What we are doing
I just said it, leading from behind.
I do think there's a joke made there, and I won't do it. hide myself. But there is a finesse to this dynamic. And you're right, Andy. I think it would be good for us to be the first one out the gate. But you know what? Part of the deftness of this is letting others lead. When you get them leading,
the leaders
are on board, you're solidifying your positioning within the broader coalition. Because at the end of the day, everyone knows we're the leader. You know, there was another snippet that the White House is not taking a lot of credit for, but they subtly talk about it, which is SWIFT. SWIFT was not, we were not going to kick Russia off of the SWIFT network.
Couldn't.
And the question came up to the president, why not? And he said one lie. He's like, well, Europe's not there. With that, every source I've talked to said that, like, turned on the machine, and within the next day, Europe was there. And that was because of Biden's public, subtle, Europe's not there. It just flipped it all. Now, if we had kicked him off or called for it, it's located in Belgium. We actually don't have any technical ability to cut Russia off of SWIFT. We need the Europeans to do it. And so this is the art of diplomacy that it's so ironic in many ways that we have a cold warrior now as our president, right?
Well, it's like being a good coach. It's like being a good coach in football. Let somebody else think that they made the decision. that's leadership, folks.
Fascinating.
And it's, we're Monday morning quarterbacking it without all the information. They've got more information than us. So you have to, at some point in time, you're going to have to respect the decision and how it was made, especially if it gets the results that we all want. We can disseminate and dissect it if we're all alive at the end of it. If it isn't, if it's a failure. But right now, I think you have to place your faith in the American intelligence.
Well, I'm going to push back a little bit on that. I don't think we just have to blatantly.
I didn't say blatantly. I said you're going to have to trust them a little bit. They know
what we do. We're giving them, but I think because we're all in agreement that we got to dig in for the long haul, we have to see where there are gaps in kind of the process.
Well, we don't know where the gaps are. we don't have the information they have. So
about a month ago, there was a political article about European ambassadors off the record complaining about their communication with the administration. So I think, especially since we're dealing with an alliance and allies, and I'm a big fan of the EU, but it is something that has to act unanimously. This becomes a lot harder if we're going to try to coach together a coalition of the willing, right? So isn't it time for us to look inside and say, okay, this is what we also have to fix communication-wise with our allies, sharing intelligence?
Well, that we know of, and yes, that we can do. The intricacies of what's going on and the communication thereof is much like being a parent or being a coach. I'm not privy to all the information that they have. I can say with reasonable effectiveness what they've done. And so what I may perceive as a gap may not be a gap. It may be a strategy or stratagem. But when those inside come out and go, hey, we need better communication. Man, I'm with you on that one, because that's one of my biggest complaints is they don't communicate.
You know, just as we talked about, Brian, you made the point, the fog of war. There's also the fog of diplomacy. You know, getting the system churning and moving in the right direction, getting the cables out to post so that the ambassadors can say things and reporting back is extraordinarily complex. That said, I think that what the Biden administration has done is a unique thing in releasing sensitive classified intelligence in a publicly possible way to try to reset the battlefield for this dynamic going forward. And we've seen that in public comms from the White House, which is a new feature to boot. So in many ways, they're kind of making this up now as well. They're figuring out their way as well about how the principles of multilateralism are there, but how do you actually execute multilateralism is a whole other ball of wax when the multilateralism is less about military and more about comms, and then of course the sanctions to boot.
You know, one of the ways they've done that is through social media, too. And social media has played a key role so far in bypassing Russian propaganda and informing people, because it's, you know, there was a special Pulitzer given this year to the young woman who created an act of journalism. She wasn't a professional journalist, but she recorded a cop standing on the kneeing someone to death in the Floyd case. And you're seeing the international equivalent of that. In this strife and struggle, and that has more than anything else led to a redesign of what you're talking about, Joel. And so it's going to be interesting going forward to see how that plays out on the international stage.
Brian, thanks for joining us. Hopefully you can play your role again, like being the first journalist in liberated Kuwait City, going back to Kyiv when it's safe.
I'll be there when it's not safe.
Yeah, but hopefully you can be the first one back when the Russians are out. We want everybody, because this is one of the values, having a free press here. This is one of the reasons we may have a better policy here and a better future compared to what the Russians want for us. So pick up Brian's book, Free the Press. You can get it on Amazon.
And wherever fine books are sold.
Yes. Well, you know, who knows? Bookstores are closing. So
the virtual bookstore.
But Brian, safe travels to Ukraine. Be safe. Yes. We look forward to having you on again.
Thanks. Brilliant.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian, for joining us. Those of you who want to keep up with Brian's work, you can go to salon.com. Joel, we got to strap on our seat belts because this is still going to be a roller coaster.
It's Andy, it's heavy. It's not going away anytime soon. And people like Brian help us to really peel back exactly what is going on in the way Americans think about this, because Americans need to think about this. It's our new reality.